I consider it a great privilege that we grew up and we could be honest about what was going on. I still work with patients and families that it's really difficult to explain, like, why is that person hospitalized? There was definitely a culture of openness and safety within our family. Now, you know, did the entire community know that the hospitalization was related to mental health? Not necessarily. I don't think. I don't know. I was a kid. But at least, like, people weren't lying to the kids when we were growing up. And I think that really helped us. It helped me just really become, like, this is a normal part. Just like diabetes and heart disease are things that you should have treatment for, your mental health is also something that you should consider treatment for.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Stable Cyclist Podcast. My name is John Peter, but most people call me JP. How's everything going today? Thank you so much for being here today and continuing to grow the podcast as you share it directly with friends, with social media, and all the other ways you pass it around. Now, today's episode is one I have wanted to share for a while, and many of you have asked me specifically to share about this topic as well. In fact, today's episode is the number one requested podcast topic people have asked me to have a guest talk about. And today we are talking about, how do you talk with a loved one when they are struggling with their mental health? And honestly, there is no better guest for me to have on today to talk about this very topic than my sister, Dr. Beth Peter. I, of course, just call her Beth, but she is a physician at Lakewood Family Medicine in Holland, Michigan. Many of you know my story, that I have bipolar disorder, or what used to be called manic depressive disorder. And in 2020, when my mental health finally collapsed in on itself, Beth was one of the four women who saved my life. And today we're going to talk about those conversations and what were some of the darkest moments and how to navigate those conversations if a loved one is having them. I chose not to have any ads today on this one because I want the focus to be entirely on what we talk about only. So, enough of all that. Let's bring in Dr. Beth Peter. Well, Beth Peter, Dr. Beth Peter, I never call you that. I just call you Beth all the time, but everyone else will call you Dr. Beth Peter. It is really good to have you here on the Stable Cyclist Podcast. And there's a lot of places we could start here. And I'm not going to be lame and be like, how's the weather in Holland, Michigan today? I've said before, it's fun having a friend on. It's even more fun having a sibling on, my only sibling, and especially to talk about a topic that has, especially in the last few years, gotten to be extraordinarily personal to us. So, yeah, thanks for coming on this week, Beth.
For sure. Yeah, no, it's so great to see you. So, it's good.
Awesome. Well, we always get things started on here with, if you're a pro cyclist, we would call it a, like, never ridden your bike to having a pro license. And if you're not a pro cyclist, my guest on the last episode, Nikki Barr, called it the zero to hero story. And so tell us, you, of course, are a doctor. You're a family practice doctor in Michigan. But as long as I can remember you, I don't have any memory of you in my head other than you wanting to be a doctor of some kind. And so tell us, like, how did you go from living in rural Minnesota to being a doctor at a pretty big family medicine practice in Michigan?
Yeah, so it's funny because you say that, and I don't have huge memories of also ever considering anything else. So for a long time, I wanted to be a vet. We grew up on a farm, obviously, in southern Minnesota, and the vets were sort of like a big deal when they came out. If you had a sick cow, or, you know, even just for the vaccines for the dogs and cats, like, they were very respected people and clearly made a difference. Yeah, yeah. They were like, wow. And they were also like super cool about having little kids hang out. Like they're doing this like dangerous high-tech work, and yet they would totally like chat you up while they were, you know, taking care of some big emergency sort of thing. So that was really cool. The problem along the way is I found out I was allergic to a lot of different animals. And so at some point along the way, it was sort of like, well, you probably shouldn't be allergic to your patients. And I found out I liked people. So, you know, that worked well. I did do a stint in college in a research lab studying melanoma in rats. I learned that research is great. I'm really thankful people do that. We need new treatments all the time. It is not something that I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing. And I think really where my heart is in preventive medicine and like family medicine. As a family medicine doctor, I take care of generations and think about, you know, how do you help people make small changes to be their best selves? And that's really what I do day in and day out. You know, went through the path of got my undergrad, was actually a music major in undergrad, went to the University of Minnesota Medical School, went to Colorado for residency, and then my husband, who is a college professor, he basically applied around the country and got a job in Holland, Michigan, and so I came with, and that's why we're in Michigan, and it's a good place, so yeah.
Yeah, for sure, it's a good place. You mentioned just preventative care being mm-hmm. so a big part of your life and what you do in your practice, and so often people don't think of mental health as preventative care. They just mm-hmm. think of the crisis that whoever yeah. they know is going through or they themselves is going through. Why is mental health for you such an important piece? It's been long before I had issues and you got involved with what I was going through. It's been mm-hmm. a big part of your life and a big passion of yours. Why is mental health that piece that would, you know, kind of push you into that preventative care where you could help people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think both because people really struggle to be physically well, to do things like get good sleep, you know, have less heart disease, have great blood pressure, if their mental health is chronically in a hard place. We grew up in a family where both addiction and bipolar disease were present, especially in the extended generations. And so that was something that was sort of prominent, right along with, you know, heart disease and diabetes. That was also something that was really talked about fairly openly, even in the 80s, at a time when mental health was really quite taboo. And I guess I'm in some ways thankful for that, I guess, that like I knew people could be functional, even if they were really struggling. But I also knew that part of sort of being your best self, staying healthy and living long, was also taking care of those things. So,
yeah, you and I have talked about how radical the environment we grew up in the sense that when I was a little kid, I knew what mental health struggles were. Like it was talked about. And like you said, there's bipolar in the extended generations, like spreading all over the family tree. And it was messy sometimes, but how important was that for us? And how important is it for other people to just have this conversation, to have mental health? It was never taboo in our family. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I know, like it was never of course we were going to talk about it.
Yeah.
How important is that?
I think that is a huge blessing. And I'm not sure like how or when that decision was made to say, look, you know, so-and-so's in the hospital this week because they were feeling so sad that they tried to harm themselves. Like that is not the way every family handles it. And it's also not the way every culture handles it. And so in some ways, sure. I consider it a great privilege that we grew up and we could be honest about what was going on. I still work with patients and families that it's really difficult to explain, like, why is that person hospitalized? And people have to each navigate that the way that is most appropriate or safest for their family. There was definitely a culture of openness and safety within our family. Now, you know, did the entire community know that the hospitalization was related to mental health? Not necessarily. I don't think. I don't know. I was a kid. But at least, like, people weren't lying to the kids when we were growing up. And I think that really helped us. It helped me just really become, like, this is a normal part. Just like diabetes and heart disease are things that you should have treatment for, your mental health is also something that you should consider treatment for.
Yeah, and there was definitely a... aside from Mr. Rogers just being very prevalent in our lives because we grew up in the 80s, there was very much a Mr. Rogers vibe about how we were talked to as kids about these things. Yeah. We were not given ever the facts of the reality of the situation, but we were talked to in a way that we understood as, you know, 5 and 9 year olds or whatever we were at the time.
Yep, absolutely. A very simple language. Only as we got older did we learn sort of more details. And that's fine. And I think that's really helpful for children to understand what is happening with their families. And for families to not feel like they're having to hide some big secret about why so-and-so can't be at Thanksgiving. Well, it's, you know, for good reason, rather than secrets. And I think that is just something that I continue to encourage people and patients to help navigate, again, in a way that's safe, but in a way that really kind of breaks down stigma. So much of mental health and even just like health in general and body image and confidence is very rooted in this idea of confidence versus shame in our culture, and just figuring out, okay, how can you be that confident? This is who I am. This is what my body does. And here's how I have to take care of it.
One of the big shifts, and some people might be like, she's just your sister, family practice doctor. How is she really going to talk about mental health with us beyond what we're going to hear? One of the things that got really on my radar with you, and this was in 2019, this was a year before I actually like fully fell apart. You were on Minnesota Public Radio, even though you work in Michigan, for your work that you're doing with ParkRx, which I want to hear about ParkRx. Even at the time, I was like, this is an amazing program, even though I didn't really recognize my need for it or like how it could help me. But just an amazing, you know, opportunity for people and what doctors are doing. And the first time that I actually heard, my sister prescribes outdoor time as the treatment for mental health, end of the sentence, I was like, what? So tell us all about this, because I don't think people understand the true value of what outdoor activity can do for us.
Sure. It's such a great question. So ParkRx America is an organization that was founded by a pediatrician. At the time he lived in the California area, he now lives in Washington, D.C. And the idea behind the program is, in addition to traditional treatments, medication, nutrition advice, all the things that you expect from a doctor, that you also start being more intentional about advising patients how to get outside. And so this is a web platform that I use at some of my office visits, certainly not all of them, and not always around mental health. Sometimes it's around diabetes, or sometimes it's around various things. And it literally sends a prescription either to a patient's phone, or if they have an old phone, we can still print them, that gives a recommendation as far as time outside. There's a suggestion we can look together at a map of green spaces in our area, and then an activity to do. And then if they're really into it, because adult learners, like, we love check-ins. They can like report back to me, hey, I went to the park 3 times this week. And then, you know, at some point, like, we continue to do the technologically based encouragement. And I use ParkRx sometimes in my office. I don't always use it. This time of year, I'm using a resource called Step It Up Ottawa County, which is actually like group-based hikes and walks and kayaking trips. I also use a handout called the Outdoor Discovery Parks Passport, which is like 14 different area parks that people can go to. And if they go to like 10 of them, then they can turn it in and get a prize. It's just all sorts of like motivation to say, okay, when you're sitting at home on the weekend and you're kind of just done, but you probably know you shouldn't just hibernate to your couch cushion and watch the 40th episode of whatever it is you're binge watching. What would be an alternative that might be healthier for you? And there's, it's really fun because I'm kind of a science nerd. And so more and more there's research backing this up that like our bodies and especially our brains are designed to be outside. And part of well-being, both from a mental and physical standpoint, is really grounded in fresh air, sunshine, a little breeze past our face. And even like in urban areas, if you're outside on your balcony with your, you know, potted plant, that gives you benefit that you might otherwise not experience if you are, you know, watching the National Geographic video indoors.
So let's say somebody doesn't live in Ottawa County, or maybe they don't even live in the United States. Are there programs? Obviously, there are a lot of programs in counties around the United States, and you can ask your general practitioner, I'm assuming, and they can point you in the right direction. Is that correct?
Or your parks staff. Like, they were so excited when I started approaching them saying, hey, I want to really collaborate with you on this project. They got pretty geeked out. So, yeah, absolutely. Talk to your local doctor. Talk to your parks and rec people, and they will get you in a place that feels safe and comfortable, and probably, you know, teach you 3 new trees along the way too.
Of course.
Of course.
So let's say you don't live in the United States, and let's even say that you don't live in what we would consider a Western country, like somewhere in Europe. Because I have quite a few listeners in places not America or Europe. How does one go about just like taking care of their mental health on a regular basis with outdoor activity? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, no, literally that means getting outside for 20 to 30 minutes a day. And you want to think about, where do I feel safe personally? So that might be a public park. It might be a backyard. It might be a friend's house. It might be, you know, there's a variety of activities. There's really interesting data about things like putting your toes in the dirt or putting your hands in the dirt, that's helpful. When I heard this, I thought, no way. And actually, there's been really great research done by indigenous people around the world about how this is actually quite helpful. And the formal term that I've learned for it is called grounding. It helps you in ways that my scientific brain does not totally understand, like just feel much more connected to the earth, but then also decreases your cortisol levels, which is something my science brain does understand. So cortisol levels are stress hormones. They're the things that we make when we're kind of in fight or flight mode. And spending 20 minutes outside, even just sitting on the lawn chair with the sun on your skin, the breeze blowing past your face, and listening to the sounds of the crickets or the birds or the buses out on the road outside, just listening, kind of using your senses, is actually really effective at lowering your cortisol every day.
Yeah, and that's where we start to see, like, because we're going to jump a lot into how to talk with and deal with a loved one who is going through some stuff. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's where you can start to see the value of, like, let's go on a walk. Let's just go sit in the grass and feel the grass. You know, like, and it sounds crazy.
It totally does. I'm like, what kind of weird, like, kumbaya stuff is this? Yeah. You know, and yet there is ancient wisdom there. Yeah. They didn't understand about cortisol and dopamine. And yet the science is really proving it out that this is important to us as human people. And that's really powerful and very cool. And I think we kind of forget that. We just think, oh, I don't have time for that today. I need to go check my email, or I don't want to miss out on whatever the, you know, next 2-hour Taylor Swift, I've listened, you know, releases. Like, I just don't have time for this. And yet it's so critical for your well-being, just like sleep is, just like eating is. It's really important. So.
Yeah. Well, and our social media brains kick into gear and we think, I don't want somebody to see me doing something that looks stupid. And so we don't even attempt it, even if no one's around.
Right.
And, and it is effective. I rarely pull back the curtain on my therapy sessions. But I will tell one really funny story from recently. It's been a real hell of a year with the post-concussion syndrome and everything. And, I was at some point, and my therapist forever has been trying to get me to do more stuff like what you're talking about. Like, just go sit and feel the grass, or like lay on the ground and feel it. And I always would just be like, bro, are you serious? I'm not doing that. Right. And at some point this winter, I realized I was just this is not even outside, but I would just shut the light off in my classroom and lay on the floor and like feel the carpet.
And your body is like this very sensate organism. It's like incredible. We just like shut all of that off all the time, right? Like,
And it would make me feel so good. I'd do it for like 2 minutes. And so I'm in this therapy session, I'm like talking through all this, and I tell her this, and she like sits bolt upright in her chair and just starts scribbling in her notebook. And she's so happy that I'm doing this finally. And like, this is super progress for me. And like all that to say, like all this stuff sounds crazy, but just think about going outside and like doing yard work, and how, even though it's kind of hard, you usually feel better when you're done doing it, even if it's for a little bit.
Yeah.
And yeah. And that's going to really transition us, Beth, that when I started this podcast and I started bringing people on, I never thought the continuous number one topic people would say, we want you to bring somebody on who can talk about how to talk with loved ones about their mental health. I never thought that would be the topic. The more I got it in as a request, the more I was like, I think I know the person that's going to help me do this. And obviously we've had John Shirky on, and he talked a lot about it from the mental health side of things. And, but when I thought about how do we talk about this, when I really fell apart in 2020, in the fall, I distinctly remember, and I tell people, there were like 4 women superheroes in my life who basically kept me alive. One was a school nurse. One was my doctor who I got handed over to. One was obviously my wife. And then one was you. And I got a phone call from you a day or two after everything had gone totally sideways. Mm-hmm. And it was a long and it was a difficult phone call. And we got done and I was ready to like take real action for the first time in years. And people are like, well, you fell apart in 2020. I had been falling apart since about 2010 or earlier. And like very clearly, and sometimes other people, including you, had tried to step in and be like, maybe you should take a look at this. And I didn't really want to hear it. And I finally was ready to listen in 2020. And because of that relationship and because of those events, I felt like you were the best person to come on and talk about how do we talk about hard things like this with loved ones? Mm-hmm. Because there's such a, you know, John Shirky talked about, we're always scared we're going to lose the relationship. And so we just hold back mm-hmm. and we're not always honest, or we're not as honest as we should be. And mm-hmm. so I don't even know how to start this conversation other than like, how do we talk to loved ones about their mental health when they're having a tough go? And sure. unravel the ball, and I'll as I see little threads come out, I'll pull on them, and we'll talk about that. So
yeah, totally. I was thinking about this beforehand because you kind of gave me a heads up this may be gonna come up, and so when we're training new doctors about how to go to a code situation, the first thing is we say stop and check your own pulse, because if you as the individual can't remain calm, it's not going to go well. And I think that's even more important when we're dealing with family. These are people we love deeply. We have a long history with them usually, and we want the best for them. And because of those things, we carry our own emotions that are very strong, but we have to be in a place where we can really approach that person from a place of love rather than a place of feeling scared or angry or fearful. And so I think if as the person thinking about how to approach your family member, you're still in a place where you feel very angry or very scared or very fearful, like, absolutely keep communication open, but maybe don't try to have a super long and in-depth conversation other than to say, I'm here for you. I'm sorry you're struggling. I'm here. And sometimes that's all people need, is just to know that their family is still there, even if they are hurt or even if they're feeling scared. I think about a lot of parents that I work with who are watching their children struggle, whether it be their adult children or their teenage children or their little children. And they just want what is best for those kids, yeah. right? In their deepest of hearts, they have dreamed for that individual to succeed and do well. And yet, like, some of the things that you can say as a parent can actually not be very helpful if you're not in an emotional place where you can step away from some of those, like, kind of fight or flight emotions yourself. So that would be my first piece of advice. Get yourself into a place where you are feeling very calm and loving and can communicate in a way where you can really read and reflect that person's emotions, which are really critical in the moment. Because probably the next thing you need to do is kind of assess, like, where are they at? Are they ready for feedback? Because there are certainly situations where someone's not ready to change. Like, they might not love their life, but they're not in a place where they're ready to hear anything you have to say other than that, hey, I'm here for you and I'm sorry you're struggling. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you failed. It doesn't mean they failed. It just means they're not ready yet. And that can be in situations of addiction. That can be in situations of, you know, really struggling with emotional regulation and management. It can be in situations like bipolar where it's like, no, I'm actually just really efficient. I don't know why you think that this is a problem, that I'm hardly sleeping. That's just how I'm made.
Mania is a hell of a drug until,
like,
it isn't.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I'm sorry that you feel like you have a lot on your plate, and I hope you get some sleep, and I'm here for you and I love you. I think so, kind of then once you've assessed yourself, start assessing when are they ready to hear insights that you might have. And then also kind of be ready to reflect some of the things that you've observed them struggling with that you might see in other people that might indicate there would be help. So you seem really stressed out when this and this happens. And I've noticed that that also happens to this person who has an anxiety disorder. Or I've noticed that you get really angry whenever this happens. And I also noticed that Dad used to do that, remember? And we always kind of thought Dad might be depressed, but he never really got help for it. I don't know. What do you think? And to be clear, we're not talking about our dad, but this is just right. like
for example.
ways that people can start to have this conversation by just telling that family member observations of recent or past behaviors that might be something that is a clue to perhaps therapy would be helpful, perhaps talking to a doctor would be helpful, perhaps seeking counseling would be helpful.
Let's say the person gets to the point where they actually like legit need help. You said sometimes people just don't want to get help. Sometimes they get themselves into a situation where they don't really have it. They're dangerous to themselves, I guess, is the way.
Yeah.
What do people do? How do people help? Because that's where, especially if you can't, like, if you don't have the tools going in, you can stay as calm as you want. You're still going to get calm and be like, well, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. What's next?
It's such a good question. So, again, we kind of assess where the person is at. If they're ready, like, wow, you just made a statement. Like, you are thinking about ending your life. Is that real? If they're saying yes, then your job is really to figure out how do we develop a safety plan? Can I stay with you? Could I bring you to the ER so we could talk to someone tonight? And sometimes the answer is no, you can't bring me to the ER, but yes, you can stay with me. And you really have to know, like, okay, what does this mean for me? Am I going to be up all night with this person? Like, and it's okay to set boundaries, to be like, I'm going to have to go to work tomorrow. How are we going to figure out a way to keep you safe? And that's okay. Some of that you kind of have to make up along the way on the fly. It's super helpful if they're ready to go to the ER. The ER 24/7 is prepared with crisis help. It's not always fast, and it's not always as touchy-feely as we would love it to be, but it is help, and it's critical. So that piece. And even if they get discharged from the ER, you still want to be really clear on what is the safety plan. So, okay, great. They decided you didn't have to get admitted to the hospital tonight. Do we need to, like, kind of change where you're sleeping tonight? Like, what's the plan? So just having those kind of conversations is important. There's times where the person may be really upset. Like, yeah, I am thinking about hurting myself, and there's nothing you're going to do to stop that. And that's the time where you have to call law enforcement. In some counties, will have like a mental health crisis team that will come out, and others literally will send the sheriff. And that's tricky because law enforcement has some training in mental health, but they are not mental health professionals. But they are trained to help keep people safe. And that doesn't always feel great. It's complicated. But sometimes if, someone is there holding a knife to their throat and won't come up with any other kind of compromise plan for safety, you have to dial 911 and you have to involve outside people. That's just bottom line. And then we hope for the best in those situations. The other thing I think sometimes we have to do is just be very comfortable with being a little uncomfortable ourselves. Yeah. You might have to do awkward things like lock up the kitchen knives. Ick, that's so inconvenient for everyone. And yet that might be what your loved one needs for a little bit to stay safe. You might be asked to, be sort of the nurse medication monitorer. That's so annoying as an adult. Are you kidding me? And yet that might be what that loved one needs to stay safe for a while. So again, you have to kind of figure out, where are my boundaries? What am I willing to do? sometimes helping people get better gets a little uncomfortable and inconvenient. And so again, you want to check your own pulse, find out where you're at, figure out what you're safe and comfortable with, act from a place of love, and just keep communicating.
Yeah, for sure. And just so that everybody knows, like, the steps she's going through that Beth's telling you, like, it is exactly what this phone call with you in 2020 was like, is you were, I was safe by then, right? Mm-hmm. And I was starting to receive some help, but you stayed calm. You talked about patterns and behaviors that you had noticed. And, mm-hmm. and of course, like we said, we had a big extended family tree to point to and be like, this might be a problem. So,
right.
And from there, once we got to those places, you were able to say some of the hard things I needed to hear at the time. But we're still very set in love and in a way that I was ready to hear them. And so that kind of brings us then, you have the crisis or you have the person who is clearly needing help. Mm-hmm. And now they have gotten help and they're diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And it is a different life moving forward, maybe than what they knew before. Not maybe, it is. And in a very good way, but in a way that takes a lot of adjusting and it's different. And so what are the best ways to then support someone in that role where your loved one has come home with this diagnosis, or they've, you know, been told you have an anxiety disorder, or you have depression, or you have bipolar, or something like that? Mm-hmm. How do you support them day to day to really help that person?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing is to ask them what they need. What do you need today? Is there anything we should be doing differently to consider as a family to help you stay well? And that might be really obvious at first, or it might not be obvious. You know, you may find over time that, oh, this never goes well. Every time we go to this person's house for Thanksgiving, that just results in crisis. Well, maybe we need a different plan. I think one of the harder things people sometimes have to do with any sort of medical thing is you have to start to look at your house's financial situation. Does someone need to drop that second job? Does someone need to pick up a different job or apply for a job where they have better pay or benefits so that we have better insurance? Like, this is just, it's icky and hard stuff, but it's really necessary. And I think people need to be thoughtful about it, because having good access and having a financial plan together where it just doesn't all fall on one person's shoulders is actually really liberating in so many medical challenges, whether it be mental health, whether it be a cancer diagnosis. Just there's so many things that piece, like, we don't want to talk about it sometimes, but you need to talk about it. You need to talk about, okay, how are we going to make this work? What kinds of problem solving things should we be doing to really help everyone just get to a better place? And that just takes communication, right? That's what this is all about, is being able to go for that walk and talk about, how's your day? What do you need today? Here's how I'm doing. I'm really struggling with this thing about your diagnosis, or this drug seems like it's doing this. What do you think? That's all real and normal. And just takes the energy of ongoing communication. So as family, we just have to keep figuring out, how do we also take care of ourselves so that we can keep having the energy to take care of others?
Definitely. And one thing that I have observed, not in our family, but in many families who reach out to me, is this is forever once that happens. Mm-hmm. And that is a paradigm that everybody has to embrace if we're actually going to make progress with mental health, especially in our country, but just in general, is that when there's a diagnosis, it's forever.
It was forever before. You just didn't have a name for it.
100% it was. Yes.
Right.
But I see so much frustration from family members of saying this person got diagnosed and they're doing their stuff and why aren't they just better? And it's the same reason all of us are humans that are like constantly right. adapting and evolving to our environments, like, and the diagnosis is going to do the same as we go along. So it's going to change and require evolution right along yeah. with us.
Yeah.
And that can be such a challenge.
Absolutely. I would never expect any of my diabetic patients to never eat something with sugar ever again in their life after their diagnosis, ever. And I hope no one else listening to this would ever expect that of any human being. And so similarly with mental health, we're not going to ask people to be perfect. And we're not going to expect that their medicine is going to fix all of the hard to live with things about them. But we're just going to keep trying to have a good day the next day. And if we have a bad day, we get to start fresh the next day and try again and reflect, okay, like, why did that fall off the rails? What can we do maybe a little differently?
Yeah. Beth, where can, you know, usually I ask people, where can people find you? You're a doctor. Doctors are private. So I'm not going to be like, where can people find you? But if people are wanting to, donate and give money to causes that are helpful, especially mm-hmm. in the things we're talking about, where can people look to support, in their communities and beyond?
Yeah. So I would absolutely, refer people, if they have a personal doctor, to just ask the question, like, what are the mental health advocacy organizations in our community? Because that is where, you know, local dollars and local influence can make the biggest impact. If you don't have a personal doctor, start looking around at where are the counseling centers. You can Google counseling at my zip code and start getting a lot of information. And some of them might have worldviews that align with yours and others might not. And I think that's important to kind of look into as well and just figure out what works. Nationally, there's several really great, the National Association for Mental Health Advocates. There's, ParkRx America is a great place that just starts with basically this idea of nature being part of the solution. And I can send you a few links as well as good, like, reputable national organizations that people could check out for really good, reputable information.
Awesome. Well, Beth, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about what is not the easiest topic to hedge through here, but one that we needed to do, and I'm sure that at some point we'll revisit it because it's something people want to hear about and want to learn about, and that's a good thing that people are wanting to learn more about how to deal with this stuff today.
Yeah, it is. It's so exciting to live at a time where we're starting to finally acknowledge that mental health has just as much of an impact on our life as our physical health, and they're actually incredibly intertwined. So,
absolutely. Dr. Beth Peter, everybody. Thanks for being here today, Beth.
Hey, we'll see you later.
Thanks for listening today. If you want more of my full story, you can check out the Bankruptcy Bike Build over on my YouTube channel, where we tear apart and rebuild a bicycle while I share my own personal mental health story. Or if you want to get really into the weeds, you can type "We Are From Pelican" into the search bar on YouTube, and there you will find a 7 long-form Netflix-style documentary following the soccer team that I coached in 2020. And of course, that was the tumultuous autumn where I fell apart. And it's right there for everyone to see in that documentary series, especially episode 4. Finally, you can find me on Instagram at The Stable Cyclist. The Stable Cyclist podcast is a twice monthly show focusing on long form conversations about bikes, mentality, and as today, when the mood was right, mental health. Episodes always drop on the first and third Friday of each month, but we'll also have bonus pods when possible. Have an amazing day. Thank you so much for listening. And most importantly, remember, you are loved.